From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Alyssa Block, and this is On Point. In the news this week, the James Comey media blitz. The fired FBI director fires back at President Trump. He spoke with CNN yesterday.
Is he adhering to our values? He's clearly not. So what do we do about it? And I think the first thing we do is not get numb to it. When he calls for the jailing of private citizens in his tweets, don't shrug, but realize that's not okay. That's not normal.
Starbucks will close its 8,000 stores for a day of racial bias training after video of the arrests of two African-American men in Philadelphia goes viral. Rashawn Nelson tells ABC's Good Morning America he hopes his arrest can open our eyes.
It's not just a black people thing. This is a people thing. And that's exactly what we want to see out of this, and that's true change. So put action into place and stop using your words.
And a Southwest Airlines pilot is being praised for her nerves of steel. She made an emergency landing after one of the engines exploded, blowing a hole in the plane.
We've got injured passengers.
Injured passengers, okay. And are you, is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Tolliv, Jeff Pagaz, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the week of Comey and the ongoing Mueller investigation? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Margaret Tolliv, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Melissa. It's great to be here.
And with us also from Washington is Jeff Pagaz. He is justice and homeland security correspondent for CBS News. Jeff, welcome back to you.
Hi, Melissa.
And with us here in the studio this time is Jack Beatty. Hey, Jack.
Hello, Melissa, Margaret, and Jeff.
And before we launch into our conversation, we do need to correct something that was said on our show yesterday. During the broadcast, one of our guests incorrectly stated that ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos had made a $75,000 donation to the Clinton campaign. In fact, as I had stated just before that answer, George Stephanopoulos donated not to the campaign, but to the nonprofit Clinton Foundation. I should have also corrected our guest during the show. I'm very sorry that I didn't, and so we are noting it now. No mistakes in today's program. We guarantee it. Moving on to today's show and more on James Comey, Robert Mueller, and the president. And Jack, let me start with you. Your impressions now that the James Comey book is out, the media tour is in full swing. We now have the memos that were released to Congress and now are made public, partially redacted. Where are we now that we weren't? Where are we now and what do we know that we didn't know last week?
Well, we're not materially advanced in facts. It seems to me that all of that has been known. What we have had, though, is a sort of display of compensatory moralism. I mean by that,
yeah.
Mr. Comey is as much responsible for Mr. Trump's election as any one person in this country. At least that's the view of Hillary Clinton. It's also the view of Nate Silver, who looked at the numbers and so on, and the effects of Comey's, you know, October was a 28th announcement, reopening this whole
email investigation.
And I think almost in compensation for that, Mr. Comey has been dishing in high dudgeon, Mr. Trump. And he said, I think, something that will ring down the years because it has some foundation. He said the president is morally unfit to be president. I don't know that that's ever been, probably has been said, but not in my hearing. And he cited, that wasn't just hyperbole. He cited the way he talks about women and has treated women. He cited his moral equivalence of the neo-Nazi demonstrators
in Charlottesville.
And he cited the there was another one, and I'm it was bad.
Rick Perry moment.
No, oh, the constant lying, which is again documented. And he said that any idea of the presidency that has never accommodated this kind of behavior. You could argue that Bill Clinton was close, but not quite to this degree. And I think that morally unfit is going to linger.
Margaret Tolliv, let me turn to you and how that message from James Comey is resonating in Washington, both in the White House, which you cover, and beyond.
You know, to some extent, it validates or bolsters which side somebody was already on if they had an impression of James Comey. And I'm going to say that more as an inside Washington thing, maybe less as a rest of the country thing. But I think, those who already don't like James Comey say like him even less because he was talking about orange skin or, you know, the size of president's hands or whatever. The people who think that Jim Comey is a hero think he's even more of a hero for putting his neck out on the line for to try to put the president on the spot. There's two real questions, and the most important one is, what is the impact, the lasting impact of the former FBI director's outreach going to be on voters, both in the midterm elections and in 2020? And the second is, materially, will it advance in any way? Maybe not the book tour, but what he's saying outside of the book tour or what he's laid out in the book, will it advance in any way? The Mueller investigation, the sort of probe writ large in all this. But it seems to me that what Comey has been doing is that he has made a very calculated decision that he doesn't believe that Donald Trump is fit to be president, and that he is going to try to galvanize public opinion in a way that just makes the whole administration seem ick, and try to have a lasting impact on voters that way, and that he has made a calculated decision that he is willing to muddy up his own kind of Boy Scout reputation a little bit in order to make the splash, get the interviews, keep the story in a sustained fashion out there.
That's the official Washington term, ick.
Yeah, Mark. It's with an I, double I-C-K.
Okay. Jeff Begays, let's bring you in, because you covered the Justice Department and Homeland Security. There have to be very strong feelings, I would think, within Justice and the FBI about what they're hearing and seeing from James Comey this week.
Yeah, I was going to use that term, ick, too, but
oh,
I'll...
Oh, shucks. Margaret stole your
maybe thunder. Next time. Well, I think... Again, supporters of Comey within law enforcement, they look at what he's doing and they support what he's doing because, in their view, this has been a White House that has attacked the justice system. It has attacked the FBI. While it says it supports law enforcement and praises local law enforcement, it has been in attack mode as far as the FBI is concerned, and specifically top officials at the FBI who've had some sort of knowledge or role in the Russia investigation. And so people who support James Comey applaud what he's doing. And from, you know, their perspective, if you look at what he's doing, they see someone who is standing up for the law. That's what they see. And, you know, Comey has been out there for the last week or so. His statements have been out there for the last week or so. It's a lot of Comey. But if you look at the landscape in Washington, no one else is speaking up when it comes to defending the FBI and the investigative process. And they see Comey doing that, and he's doing that repeatedly in these interviews, and they support him. However, there are those in law enforcement who feel that he talks too much. Mm. And they've felt that for quite some time, at least dating back to July 5th, 2016, when he came out and made the statement about Hillary Clinton's private email server. It was at that point that the FBI was under the microscope because of those statements that Comey made on that day. He opened the FBI open to a lot of criticism. And so you do have those who say that Comey talks too much, always has, and they're seeing it again this week.
Jeff, let me stick with you for just a minute, and let's talk about just where we are with the Mueller investigation that has now spawned a separate federal investigation in the Southern District of New York in federal court of Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen has dropped a civil lawsuit. We don't need to get into the weeds about that. But what does that say about where that criminal probe is heading and what the jeopardy he is in might be?
Well, what it says is that Cohen is concerned about this criminal probe. And I have talked to people who are close to him who say that he expects to face charges in connection with that criminal probe. You know, this was the raid that was carried out over a week ago on his office, his hotel room, his home. It was a very aggressive raid. raid, and it's brought up these questions about attorney-client privilege, because some of the search warrants were obviously covering some of his communications with President Trump. So Cohen and his attorneys obviously see this as the primary focus, and they're trying to sideline these other issues. There was the defamation lawsuit against BuzzFeed and Fusion GPS. He's now dropped that.
That had to do with the Steele dossier, so-called Steele dossier that was released, yeah.
Exactly. And when I talked to Cohen about that in January, when he announced it, he said enough is enough. You know, he was tired of the fake Russia dossier, but apparently things have changed because he's now announced that he's dropping that. He's trying to delay the Stormy Daniels case for about 90 days. They're essentially clearing the decks and protecting him from further possible incrimination by something that he says in these civil cases. But he is concerned about this criminal case.
Margaret Tolliff, how concerned is the White House about that criminal case? And I suppose there is the possibility, as Jeff Pegues has reported, that Michael Cohen, as loyal as he has always been to Donald Trump, could flip, turn against him.
Well, so for that to mean something, we need to know that they, you know, that there's something to give on President Trump. And President Trump seems to have gotten at least quasi assurances from Rod Rosenstein that he's not like the target of all of this. Although it doesn't mean that they can't discover something in what they found in Michael Cohen's various offices and, you know, spaces that they've been through. So the main question is what are they, finding in there? And We think that Michael Cohen didn't have like that many clients, so it's going to be sort of like a concentrated stash of stuff. They're looking through, but we are seeing the president expand that legal team now very quickly. I guess just in case he needs other lawyers for other bits and pieces of this.
Margaret Tolliff, Jeff Pegues, and Jack Beatty here with me in the studio. Stick with us. We're going to be continuing this conversation and talking about much more in the hour to come. We are talking about the week in news, and you can join the conversation. What do you think of Mike Pompeo's secret meeting with Kim Jong-un? What about the confusing signals from the White House on Russia sanctions? And what are your thoughts about Starbucks and racial bias after the arrests of two black men in Philadelphia? I'm Alyssa Block. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. Can technology reduce healthcare costs? What will it take to personalize the education of every student? And where does the media go from here? Find these answers and more on Trailblazers, a podcast hosted by best-selling author Walter Isaacson and joined by extraordinary guests who share their stories, insights, and the lessons they learned while transforming entire industries. Stream Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app or at delltechnologies.com/trailblazers.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And this week, it's all about Operation Earth, how to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Alyssa Block. We are looking at the week in news, everything from James Comey and President Trump to North Korea and Russia to Starbucks. We would love you to join the conversation. I'm talking with our news analyst, Jack Beatty, also Jeff Pegues of CBS News and Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg. And let's go back to the Comey tapes, the Comey book, the memos, and also the Robert Mueller investigation in particular. On Tuesday, the majority leader in the Senate, Republican Mitch McConnell, told Fox News that legislation designed to protect special counsel Robert Mueller from being fired by President Trump was unnecessary, and he said he wouldn't bring it to the Senate floor.
That's not necessary. There's no indication that Mueller's going to be fired. I don't think the president's going to do that. And just as a practical matter, even if we passed it, why would he sign it?
Jack Beatty, let me start with you. What about the Robert Mueller investigation and when the constant drumbeat of will he or won't he, President Trump, fire Robert Mueller?
Well, the words you see about the president regarding the investigation, especially now that it's trenching on his personal business, which he said was a red line, the words you see are seething and, you know, volcanic and full of rage and so on. And perhaps Rod Rosenstein is one tweet away from losing his job because I think it would have to go that way through the through the Justice Department, and there's been some evidence that the Republican chairman in the several of them in the Congress have been trying to set Rosenstein up and get him for not producing evidence and so on. He did finally give these memos, which I guess lifted that cloud. But I think there'll be another one. And, you know, the majority leader is basically, I won't say he's giving the president a yellow light, but it is not a firm red light.
Jeff Pegues, explain how this works in terms of Robert Mueller and what would happen, what would have to happen if he were to be, say, fired, removed from the investigation. It's complicated.
It's complicated, but one thing is for sure, it would cause an uproar, just like the firing of Comey did on May 9th of 2017. But this would be much bigger. The tremor felt in Washington and throughout the country. You know, in fact, we've seen some reports of some cities preparing for the reaction that might come if he is fired. So,
really?
Yes.
In terms of civil unrest.
Well, exactly. So there are politicians on Capitol Hill who are concerned about what might happen and the reaction to it if the president fires Mueller. But we've heard from investigators that the investigation will continue. Even if Mueller goes, the investigation will continue because it's that far along. We're, you know, well over a year into this. Keep in mind that the FBI had control of the investigation for about 10 months before the special counsel took up the investigation. Mm-hmm. And so this has been ongoing for some time. There is a lot of evidence. You already have some indictments and guilty pleas. So even if Mueller is fired, it will continue. But there will be a reaction to this firing if it happens.
Let's go to the phones. We have two callers waiting, both from North Carolina. Drew calling from Maxton, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hello, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to say, for the most part, it's kind of like that clown car you see in the circus with all the clowns getting out of it, and you wonder how many more clowns can get in or get out of it. It's like it's upside down, and they're all falling out. You've got Mr. Comey, who in turn, he should not, in my opinion, have went before the American people saying that they had re-investigated Hillary Clinton's emails, because that did help turn the tide of the election. But if he was going to do that, he should have also said that they were probing Mr. Trump.
So wait, who are the clowns in the car exactly?
Well, the clowns
trying to follow your metaphor
that
here.
I'm referring to is the fact that you've got Cohen, Trump's lawyer, that went over to Prague and helped sweep this crap with this Stormy Daniels girl and all this other stuff under the rug to keep it from coming out before the election. He, in turn, like you said, dropped those charges against different people, different entities, because they had said that he did go over there, and he said he didn't. Now it's coming out that he actually did go. I mean, how many more Russians got to fall out of this car before we know that there's something going on, even to those stupid Trump pets, who I call Trump supporters? Those people are, what is it going to take for them to before they swear allegiance to Vladimir Lenin and say that Putin is now their new leader because this guy that we've got in the White House is a complete nincompoop?
Okay. Well, thank you, Drew, from Maxton. Some strong words there from Drew, and he mentioned Trump supporters. We have a Trump supporter online, also from North Carolina, David calling from Charlotte. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, I think that, you know, nobody likes sanctimony, or few people like sanctimony, and nobody likes a hypocrite. And I think that James Comey is a sanctimonious hypocrite. He, and the guy, the last part, first of all, there's no proof. I don't know where the proof is that Cohen went to Prague. I don't know where that came from. But it's amazing to me that you guys give the credibility to James Comey, who hates Trump, but yet would have worked for him for six more years.
Well, let me pitch that point, David, to Jeff Pegues. Is it clear to you that James Comey hated Trump, as David is saying there, as he as he began his time with President Trump or President-elect Trump, or did that evolve over time? And I don't know that he would use the word hate. I think he had some serious qualms about him, as he says, as Jack pointed out, as being morally unfit to be president.
Yeah, hate is a strong word, and I don't think that James Comey has said or really indicated that he hates the president. However, as you mentioned, he has concerns about the president's actions in those meetings, and that is outlined in the seven memos that I've been reading through over the last 12 hours or so. So he had concerns about the president's conversations with him about the dossier, about Flynn, and then about pledging loyalty. But to the caller's point about Michael Cohen, there is a report that said that investigators have been able to confirm that he traveled to Prague, which was alleged in that dossier. Mm-hmm. However, I've spoken with Michael Cohen about this numerous times. He says that is not true. In his view, he has said it until he's blue in the face. He keeps saying it, that he did not travel to Prague and that his passport backs that up. But obviously, he is under a criminal investigation in connection with the Stormy Daniels case. And he has been under scrutiny in the Russia investigation as well. So obviously, that is something that investigators are looking to. But as of right now, we have a report that says that he went to Prague, and he denies going to Prague.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for that. And also going back to the caller's claim that James Comey hates, in his words, President Trump, we should say that James Comey did explicitly say on CNN in his interview yesterday that he does not hate President Trump. Let's pivot and talk a bit about foreign relations here and to a potential summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. During a news conference on Wednesday with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at Mar-a-Lago, President Trump says he still could pull the plug on that summit.
If I think that it's a meeting that is not going to be fruitful, we're not going to go. If the meeting when I'm there is not fruitful, I will respectfully leave the meeting.
And Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg, let me turn back to you. It's unclear when that meeting would take place, where it would take place. But we did learn this week a surprising fact that Mike Pompeo, the current CIA director, potentially the next Secretary of State, had gone to North Korea and met with Kim Jong-un.
It was really quite incredible. It was like a Jason Bourne movie or something, like Mike Pompeo, Easter weekend, you know. But
secret flight.
And then like the wave two, which all the comedians seized on, which was like, oh, my God, Trump can keep a secret. But, you know, so they have been aiming for May. It's quite possible to slide into June at this point. But all the various pieces have come into place that would need to happen before a meeting like this. Right. The U.S. has been meeting and talking with Japan and South Korea. China and the U.S. have been talking. China and the North Koreans have been talking. The Swedes, who are, you know, have diplomatic relations with the U.S. and North Korea, have been talking to foreign ministers. So like all these various pieces and by the president's account, they had narrowed it down to roughly five sites, some in Europe, some in Asia. All the steps are moving forward to allow this meeting to take place. At the same time, I have to say that part of that soundbite, or what that soundbite turned into, was the president saying, and, you know, I might just walk out in the middle of it, yeah, if I don't like the way things are going. And that's the stuff that diplomats, foreign policy experts, former national security advisors from both, you know, Republican and Democratic administrations, that's the kind of thing that just makes everybody cringe.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, look, there's nobody that I've ever talked to that thinks that President Trump is going to meet with Kim Jong-un and all of a sudden, like, North Korea is not going to have any nuclear ambitions. But if this, you know, this meeting has the potential to move the diplomatic ball forward, and there are all kinds of other variables. There are, you know, three Americans still being held in North Korea. There are assurances that the Japanese and the South Koreans want. It's theoretically possible they could make a progress on an actual treaty to end the Korean War, which we all thought was over, but actually isn't technically. You know, so there is a lot of important stuff that could come out of the summit if it takes place. But it is the potential for an outburst like, I might just walk out of this if it's not working, that still has a lot of people nervous about, you know, precisely the words get carried out.
And a lot of international players who have a stake in this as well. Let's go back to the phones. We have a call on this issue from John in Youngstown, Ohio. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I have a lot of suspicions of the war hawks in this government, the military-industrial complex, that they're going into this grudgingly, simply as was hinted in the previous comment, to pretend they're going to bring something positive out of this, but go through the motions and then have all kinds of escape hatches where they can say, I'm not satisfied, or North Korea's not acting in good faith, and gee, we gave them a chance, and now we can go full bore back to the warmongering.
Why are you suspicious, John?
Well, I read an article in Global Research, which gives a globalresearch.ca, which has a lot of credited people. And one that they quoted was Trump's own intel chief, Dan Coats, who at a Aspen meeting of some of these elite militarists didn't know he was being overheard and it was leaked. But he said that Kim Jong-un is not crazy, is not mad. He's acting very rationally. And he learned from the U.S. destruction of Iraq, Libya, after they were disarmed, to never give up their to get nukes and to never give up nukes. Now, that coming from Trump's own intel chief, Dan Coats, when he didn't think he was going to be quoted, shows that they know that North Korea, I think, has a very justified fear of the United States after having one-third of their people carpet-bombed and burned to death in the Korean War. And since that, for 70 years, has had practiced rehearsals with huge, ferocious military operations at their coast and borders and waters and even inside their country for 70 years, something we wouldn't tolerate for seven minutes.
Yeah. John, thanks from Youngstown, Ohio. Thanks for joining us with that thought. And a counterpoint call that I just want to turn to briefly, Andy from Butler, Pennsylvania. You have some thoughts on North Korea as well? You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I remember, you know, back when President Trump was first elected and started making moves about North Korea with their missile tests, everyone was worried we were going to war. We were going to war. And that taking a tough stand with North Korea was the wrong way to go about it. But look now. We've got the North Korean leader is going to have a meeting with the South Korean president. We've got a possible end to the Korean War. The requirement that the United States completely abandon South Korea is being talked about, not being taken away from what North Korea would want for a peace. It seems like perhaps the president took the right attitude in going into this, and it's resulted in the prospect for a negotiation. And I find it very disingenuous that that the people on your panel make a laugh, but they still decide to not go.
Let me, Jack Beatty, have you respond to Andy from Butler, Pennsylvania, and what he was saying there.
Well, the South Korean president has essentially backed him up and said that Mr. Trump's sanctions and even his tough rhetoric deserve a lot of credit. You know, Trump is on a path that could lead to a Nobel Peace Prize, impeachment insurance, and re-election.
Wait, what are you talking about there, Jack?
If peace comes to Korea along the lines that is now being talked about in ways we couldn't even be imagined, Mr. Trump is going to get and deserve immense credit, unlike President Obama, who really didn't deserve his Nobel Peace Prize. Mr. Trump will deserve it. The question is, can he, as one of our callers, John, raised the question, can he, does he have the wit to see that, to see this is his moment? And John Bolton and Pompeo and the hawks, can he turn them down and listen and essentially see his own prospects here? Because that's what's in that's the direction he could go. And on the other hand, it could go toward war in the way that John said. Then they could say, well, we've tried everything with this guy. We met with him, didn't work, nothing for it now, but to, what's the metaphor they use? Give him a black eye or a punch in the nose. And who knows? But this is Mr. Trump's moment. in every sense. And the question is, will he rise to it? Does he even see it?
I'm intrigued by something that Jack just said there. Is anybody else hearing talk that, Donald Trump could be in line for a Nobel Peace Prize if, anything is resolved in North Korea?
Yes.
Well, some of the discussions yes. about where to hold the meeting, have mentioned the location of the awarding of the Nobel Prize. But to go back to Andy's point,
briefly, Margaret, before the break,
Of course, I can certainly hear a lot of passion and emotion in there, but I'm not sure what he's hearing because I think this panel all feels like the president has a tremendous opportunity if he's careful about his next steps.
Fair enough. We're discussing this week's biggest news stories. You can join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know your thoughts. We'll be talking about airline safety and the pilot who safely landed a crippled Southwest Airlines jet. Remarkable tape of her talking with air traffic control. I'm Melissa Block, and you're listening to On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. And in other news this week, Desiree Linden braved bitter cold, biting wind, and torrential rains to become the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985.
Arms raised, a fist pump, and Des Linden wins the Boston Marathon!
And NPR veteran Carl Castle, who spent 30 years as Morning Edition's newscaster and found a second home as the official judge and scorekeeper for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, died on Tuesday at age 84.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle.
That voice. And rapper Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer Prize for Music for his 2017 album, Damn, becoming the first winner who is not a classical or jazz composer. Here's the album's lead single, Humble.
Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down.
And we welcome you to join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined once again by Jeff Pagaz with CBS News, also Margaret Tolliv of Bloomberg, and Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst. And I want to turn to another point of curiosity from this week. It has to do with sanctions on Russia. And on Tuesday, we heard White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow dismissing what U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley had said. She had promised there would be future, in fact, immediate sanctions against Russia.
She got ahead of the curve. She's done a great job. She's a very effective ambassador. There might have been some momentary confusion about that.
Momentary confusion, a little bit of mansplaining there from Larry Kudlow. In a statement later that day, Haley said, quote, "With all due respect, I don't get confused." Larry Kudlow did later apologize, told the New York Times that he was totally wrong to say that because policy had changed and Haley wasn't told about it. Margaret Tolliv, this is pretty serious stuff. A very profoundly mixed message from the White House. What happened?
Well, I think people are going to be now watching this kind of triangle, trapezoid. I'm not entirely sure
how many
what the
sides
pattern
does
is.
It have.
I mean, look, there are a few questions. Which is number one: was Nikki Haley purposefully cut out of the loop, and by whom? By the president? By John Bolton? Who did it, and why? Number two: was she not cut out of the loop? Knew that there was talk of sanctions and wanted to put it out there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that's not what happened. Number three, what is going on with Nikki Haley and Vice President Mike Pence, who you could have thought about a while ago as rivals to perhaps one day consider a run, you know, in what year are we talking about, 2024? And now they're looking at taking her pollster and making it his national security, deputy national security advisor. But that's off because the president found out about it and it became embarrassing. There is a lot of like weird drama that wasn't there a few weeks ago. And this kind of exposed all of that. But OK, so that's palace intrigue. Let's set it aside. From a policy perspective, yes, it is a bad situation if the UN ambassador, who until now has been absolutely taken as having her finger on the pulse of what is happening, gets out in front, and the rules have changed and she doesn't know about it. That's a problem because it undercuts her, weakens her, and it undercuts the message at a really important time. She has also been one of the most hawkish or aggressive voices in the administration on Russia and how to deal with Russia. And so, again, you see all of those fault lines exposed with this.
I want to pivot now to the Starbucks story. We mentioned that the arrest of two black men who were sitting in a Starbucks in Philadelphia had not ordered anything. The manager called police. They were arrested. Starbucks has now said it will close all of its stores for a one-day racial bias insensitivity training. We heard on Thursday from the police commissioner in Philadelphia, Richard Ross, who apologized to the two black men, saying he regretted what he initially said, which was that his officers had done nothing wrong. Here's his apology.
It is me who, in large part, made most of the situation worse than it was. And so for that, you know, it is my sincere apology to those two men and even to these officers and to the other people around this city who I failed in a variety of ways on this incident.
And the police commissioner, Richard Ross, saying also, shame on me. Jeff Pegues, you've written a book about these issues, Black and Blue, Inside the Divide Between the Police and Black America. What's your takeaway from what's happened in Philadelphia and how Starbucks is responding?
Well, I think Starbucks has been effective in its response. You know, there have been a lot of discussions around dinner tables in homes across America about the incident. You know, millions of people across this country obviously go to Starbucks, black, white, Latino, all different backgrounds. But in black households, are there times where you feel singled out? For some reason, in some establishments, yes. And clearly, Howard Schultz has acknowledged that this was a problem, took full responsibility. Now you have the police chief in Philadelphia apologizing as well. And even though Starbucks has been effective handling this situation, this is the type of incident that happens across the country that people of color often face. And, you know, you talk to people around the country, people that I've interviewed, whether they're community activists or even police chiefs, until you have an open and honest conversation about interactions between different people in these communities across the country, you will continue to have incidents like this. In cities across America, what we've seen is that the number of hate crimes have been going up. The police chief here in Washington, D.C., said that just a couple of days ago. Over the last three or so years, hate crimes have been going up. There's a reason for that. So what you see in these incidents of alleged bias, that is an issue that is being dealt with in different ways and in different environments across the country. It is a problem that people are facing in different areas across the country.
And let's take a call on this topic from Toronto. Bernard calling from Toronto and from our neighbor to the north. Bernard, you're welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi, Melissa.
Hi.
I think too much attention is being paid to Starbucks. Starbucks is not complicit in what happened here at all as a company. To me, I mean, of course, the employee, sure. But to me, the biggest onus is on the police. The police are called all the time into situations, and they have to use their discretion. You know, you go into Starbucks, you see that there's nothing going on there. You talk to the individuals involved. You talk to the people that work at Starbucks. You try to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
There was absolutely no reason to put these men in handcuffs.
So an overreaction, Bernard is saying there. Jeff Pegues?
Well, there is this theory of de-escalation.
Yeah.
That police departments are talking about across this country instead of being in situations where your officers turn up the heat, if you will, when they confront people in the community, why not try and de-escalate the situation? And perhaps the caller has a point. Perhaps the officer should have gone into the store, talked to the person who called them, determined whether there was probable cause to arrest them. And if indeed the men, as we now know, were just sitting there, perhaps the police officers should have said that, you know, we can't just arrest them for sitting here in this restaurant. So, you know, could de-escalation tactics have worked here? Probably.
Bernard, I'm curious if that answer makes sense to you, and also just the notion of blacks who feel that they are just perpetually not allowed to do things that nobody looks the other, nobody says anything when whites do in the same situation. For example, in this case, asking to use the restroom when they hadn't bought anything, or asking, or right. just sitting at a table when they hadn't bought anything.
That's exactly correct. Black people can't be themselves. You know, and the stress involved in this, you know, you go out there, you try to be like everybody else, but black people don't get the benefit of the doubt, especially when it comes to the police.
And isn't the burden of how to handle that, though, on Starbucks? I mean, that wouldn't that explain that day of racial sensitivity, racial bias training that they're talking about, closing down all 8,000 of their stores, which is quite an act.
Well, yeah, and I admire Starbucks for doing that. Mm-hmm. I admire the CEO. He's a genuine guy. But to me, he took it upon himself more than he should have. Uh-huh. I mean, the problem is really the police. You know, they are the ones that are misbehaving here. Of course, the manager at Starbucks, she did the wrong thing too. But nobody's talking about the police. The police is where the problem is.
Bernard, thank you so much for your call. Bernard in Toronto calling there. Let's switch gears one more time. I am fascinated, I have to say, by the story of the Southwest Airlines jet that a pilot, a female pilot, Tammy Jo Schultz, was able to land after one of its engines exploded. Sounds like just a terrifying scene. The engine exploded. The cowling around the engine did not protect shrapnel, and the shrapnel blew a hole in the plane. A window was blown out. A woman passenger was sucked partially out of the window, later died of her injuries. The pilot was able to land the plane successfully. There's a remarkable, if you haven't heard it, I would suggest you go listen to it, exchange. You can hear the exchange of her talking to air traffic control and bringing that plane safely down. She sounds like she could just be asking for a runway on any normal flight. Passengers afterwards said, you know, she not only had nerves of steel, as one person said, but that she afterward went back into the cabin and shook the hands of every single passenger on that plane. Margaret Tolovite, I know this is not something you cover, but it does raise questions. And I should mention, too, they're now looking into just what happened with that engine and whether they're, you know, what caused the engine failure. According to the Associated Press, Southwest did oppose an FAA recommendation that would have inspected fan blades like the one that snapped during that fatal engine failure. Margaret Tolove, did you listen to that conversation, that air traffic control conversation? Have you read stories about this?
It is an absolutely captivating story. And, like, who doesn't want to be girl buddies with this pilot? Like, she sounds amazing, right? But she's the Sully, right? She's the female Sully of 2018. We're still obviously—
You're talking about Captain Sully Sullenberger, who landed the plane in the—
right.
Hudson River, East River. I think it was Hudson River.
This woman has captivated the imagination and the hearts of a lot of Americans, men as well as women, and everybody wants to know more and everybody wants to hear more from her, although I think because the investigation is still so fresh, Southwest has not been eager to do that. Look, this is a tragedy. I mean, somebody died, and this is a terrible failure on someone's part, and the facts will come out. But if you're going to have a tragedy, it is about as heroic of an ending as you can imagine, and all those other people who were protected. And you're exactly right. When you listen to that call, it is remarkable, not for the drama in her voice, but for the absolute absence of drama. You would have no idea there was a terrible situation unfolding and absolute chaos just behind her on that plane.
Yeah, she says, we have part of the aircraft missing, so we're going to need to slow down a bit as they approach that runway. Jeff Pegues, one other interesting note here, that pilot, Tammy Jo Schultz, was a Navy pilot and was, I believe, the first female to fly an F-A-18. She was rejected, apparently, by the Air Force. They would not let her do what she wanted to do, and she went to the Navy.
Yeah, and she is a top-notch pilot over the years. There's been a lot of criticism of pilots and the dulling of their skills because of the automation of these planes. But she showed in her reaction and how she was able to, you know, bring the plane down safely that is just not the case across the board.
And Margaret is absolutely right that apart from the heroics of this one incident, it does raise very troubling questions about airline safety. I want to take some time here to remember Barbara Bush, who died this week, former first lady, former wife of a former president, and mother of a former president, known for lots of things, for a very sharp tongue, for being very forthright, and also for campaigning very actively for family literacy. Let's take a call. We have Bill calling from Rockingham, Virginia, with some thoughts on Barbara Bush. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Melissa. Two comments, one quick question.
Sure.
There was a cartoon in our paper today that says that how do we honor the legacy of Barbara Bush? And the answer was spend time with your family and read a child a book.
Huh.
I thought that was pretty good.
Read your child a book. Yeah.
Last Tuesday, I was in NPR Live. Last Tuesday, I think it was, you went an hour and 53 minutes without saying Donald Trump is the devil. And I don't know whether you're slipping or what.
Okay. Bill, I'm going to stick with your first point about Barbara Bush, if you don't mind, and about reading your child a book. Jack Beatty, thoughts on Barbara Bush, what she represents to the country?
Well, someone this week who'd been in her home in Houston said that right inside the door there was a motto on the wall, and it was, "Why do birds fly so high? Because they carry themselves so lightly."
Hmm.
That was her grace, self-deprecation, joking about herself, about her appearance, about her husband, about her sons. And I think that was no small part of the ingredient leading to Bush political success. President Bush the First certainly carried himself lightly. He used to talk about his, sort of distant relation with the English language. And George W. Bush also was a big man for self-deprecation. And I think that took the aristocrat off the It took that the shine of that off them and made them seem what they were, which was very regular people dedicated to the country, as she was. There's no question about
it. With very aristocratic backgrounds.
With very aristocratic backgrounds.
Margaret Tollett, final thoughts on Barbara Bush?
She was one tough lady, but she was tough on herself, too. She loved America, and she is a reminder of the real reach that first ladies, even though they don't hold executive power, can have on the hearts and the minds of Americans.
And Jeff Pagés.
Well, I cover these tough stories, but I'm an old softy. And when I see these stories of the love that she and George H. Walker Bush shared, that moves me. 73 years of marriage, that's incredible.
Yeah. And I should also say here, what I've been moved by is just listening to and hearing all the tributes from NPR listeners who are so fondly remembering our friend and colleague Carl Castle. So thanks to everybody who's weighed in on that.
Amen.
And thanks for listening. Margaret Tollef, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Pagés, justice and homeland security correspondent with CBS News. Jeff, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Melissa.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Melissa.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Melissa Block. This is On Point.